Hey, it's Shimon, and this is the Faith Through Music podcast. Here we speak with artists, creators, and musicians about how faith influences their music and how music influences their faith. Today I had the pleasure to speak with Lenny Solomon. Lenny is the founder of Schlockra. He has released 39 albums, written hundreds of songs, and inspired generations with his parodies and original music. We discuss how Schlockra got started, the elements that make up a good parody, the importance of simcha, joy, in life and music, the educational aspect of his music, and so much more. Lenny, thank you so much for joining me.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
I'm going to start with something a little bit more fun. You started playing the accordion when you were really young, and it's interesting how both you and Weird Al, who are two of the most well-known parody artists, both started on the accordion. Do you think there's some connection between the accordion and parody music?
Well, first thing is to put me on the same level with Weird Al Yankovic is a tremendous compliment because he's obviously sold a lot more units or downloads or is a lot more famous than I am. But I will tell you that in the late 60s, which is, I was 8 years old in the late 60s. I was born in 61. Mm-hmm. So in the late 60s, everybody played accordion. And I think this is why I think Weird Al played accordion, and I think it's why I played accordion, which is that it was actually an in instrument. Everybody, all my friends took accordion lessons.
It's fascinating.
I took accordion lessons. My friends took accordion. Now, I was the only one where I kept going. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that it's necessarily a coincidence that me and Weird Al, because Weird Al's a couple years older than me. I think he's like 62, 63. Uh-huh. I don't remember for sure. But anyway, so I took accordion lessons from the age of, I think it was, eight, from the age of eight, March 1969, I started going to take accordion lessons, and I took from eight till 18. I took 10 years of accordion. And then while I was 15, I switched to piano. Uh-huh. So, and I didn't switch. I kept accordion going, and I added piano, so I had two instrument lessons at the same in 1 week.
Yeah, that definitely leads for a busy musical week, that's for sure, growing up. How do you get then from playing accordion and piano to playing in bands, which I know you had a few bands before Schlockrock, and then kind of moving towards that?
Well, so when I got to be 18, I finished high school, which I went to MTA, for everybody out there who big into Yeshiva University High School. That's where I went. Graduated in 78, and I went to Queens College, where I majored in accounting and I minored in music. But I really didn't minor in music. I majored in music. I just didn't take the tests at the end. Uh-huh. Because I took 60 credits of music and I took 60 credits of accounting. And when I was 20 years old, I got a phone call from a friend of mine, Avi Feinberg, his name was. It was September 81. He said, Lenny, would you like to do an NCSY Shabbaton? Now, at that time, I said to him, what is NCSY? Because I grew up in Kew Gardens, Queens. Kew Gardens Synagogue had its own youth center. We didn't have any outside youth groups. Uh-huh. We didn't have Bnei Akiva. We didn't have Benos. We didn't have, Pirche. We had the Kew Gardens Synagogue Youth Center. That's what we had. So I said to Avi, what is... NCSY, what is this? And so he told me, and so I went for a Shabbaton. And that was with a band called the Shemesh Orchestra. My first band was called the Shemesh Orchestra. Mm-hmm. And we did Shabbatons for New York region that year. We also played weddings and bar mitzvahs. One of my cool stories is that I once played a wedding in San Juan, Puerto Rico. We flew to San Juan. I was early 20s. That was fantastic. That was also for the Shemesh Orchestra, I think. It was actually for the Avi Meza Orchestra, I believe. Uh-huh. So, and then from there, I started doing Shabbatons in other regions. And there I reconnected with Tzvi Pill. Tzvi Pill was a drummer who I had played with in Camp Dora Golding. And Tzvi Pill and I formed a band with Joey Friedman and Shlomo Horowitz called Kesher. And it was there that we put out our first album. In 1984, I put out an album. Now, meanwhile, I was an accountant. I was working from 82 to 85 as an accountant, but I knew as soon as I went to these Shabbatons and as soon as I put out my first album that I didn't want to be an accountant for the rest of my life. I wanted to be a musician, which was kind of an interesting thing because that's what my father said that I would be doing. Uh-huh. My father said he wanted me to go to Juilliard, get my master's in music, and become a musician full-time. And I said, Dad, how am I going to make a living? So instead, I didn't listen to him, went to Queens College, and majored in accounting. And so
I did the same, so I definitely know the accounting route. That's my side also.
Well, you see what I'm saying? So accounting, by the way, and accounting and music are very similar. The math and the music are very, very same, you know, similar in terms of the, what's it called? There's a synchronicity between math and music. That's the Ramchal says that. Anyway, so Rabbi Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, for those don't know who the Ramchal is, he wrote great, great philosophical books about how to live your life. Anyway, so there I am, and it's now I'm in Kesher. And in Kesher, after watching these NCSY Shabbatons and watching people getting up on chairs on Shabbat and doing parodies, I said to myself, I can do this. And I started writing my own parodies, which were Abarbanel, Hit Me With Your Best Shot, which was the first one. That came out on Kesher 1. Uh-huh. Abarbanel and Eliyahu HaNavi and Born in the USA, Making Aliyah Today, and Old Time Torah Scroll. And that came out on the first album, which came out in January of 86. By this time, I'm out of accounting totally, right? So I left accounting in June of 85, and I became the music director of the Jewish Music School Youth Organization, a Jewish public school youth organization, where I would go into public schools and I would play Schlock Rock to kids to try to help them get closer to Judaism. And that's what Schlock Rock was used for in NCSY. It wasn't called Schlock Rock in NCSY. In NCSY, when people got up and did songs, it was called shtick. Uh-huh. You're doing shtick, right? But I came up with this name Schlock Rock. It popped into my head. People didn't like it. A lot of people didn't like it. They said change the name, but I didn't listen.
clearly you had the right way with that.
Well, I don't know. I mean, some other people said, no, we have to call it something else. But the thing that I learned was that the way to go is, you know, the way to go is that you have people who have to hear a name, they have to have an opinion. So either they have to like it or they have to hate it. But if they have a power of opinion where they don't care, that's no good.
Then you really lost at that point.
Yes, you want people to have you want people to say something. You want people to say, oh, that's a great name, or ooh, I hate that name, you know, and then they have an opinion, and then you have to win them over.
Yeah.
So Schlock Rock, I was, you know, I never, that's it. Once it became Schlock Rock, that was it. That's the name. And you know, when we released the album in January of 86, 3 months later, I got a letter from a lady who said, my brother hates Judaism, but he's listening to your cassette around the clock. Keep up the good work.
Nice. That's the high praise.
Yes, it was the first indication that I would make a second one, because until that point, I was in Hasidic music and I did songs like V'samachta Bechagecha V'hayitach Sameach. I actually wrote that song, and that was that became a standard that even Shweki used on a CD,
yeah,
or on a compilation, a holiday compilation. So I was writing Hebrew music, and then all of a sudden, you know, I never thought that Schlock Rock would be more than a one album comedy cassette. And then I started getting letters, and some of the letters were really amazing, like that letter from that lady in Florida, and then there was another letter from a guy in Seattle. And then there was a bad letter from somebody in Cleveland who didn't sign their name, but they said, "Dear Lenny, the Abarbanel would be rolling in his grave if he knew what you did to his name." And I don't think I responded, but my response it was, "Nobody knows who the Abarbanel is. This is telling people who the Abarbanel is. This is perfect."
It's like the other side, they talk about it with social media, is the fact that somebody took the time to write a letter and mail it means that they actually had to put in serious effort.
Yes.
To say the negative side to it, which is also, like you're saying, about getting any kind of eyeballs on something is eyeballs in that way.
It really wasn't. Yes. And I had to start developing a thick skin, because in the beginning, rabbis would come up to me and say, what is this? You know, what are you doing? And I would say, but this is fun. This helps people enjoy Torah. It helps people enjoy Judaism. It helps people get closer to God. It teaches. And that's when I started working on my second album, and I started, every song was going to have an educational message. So Under the Chuppah, which was the second album, teaches about a Jewish wedding, and Achashverosh teaches about Achashverosh and the holiday of Purim, and so on and so on and so on. So every album was educational. It became, and I didn't know it, it was informal Jewish education through music and media. Mm-hmm. Which is where I was heading, but I didn't know. I was just using my creative juices, and this is what was coming out.
Interesting. Is that eventually what flipped the scales on some of the rabbis that didn't necessarily like what you're doing initially? Like, what convinced them, like, oh, this really is working, this is something, like, we're not going to push back against it?
I think they actually listened to the music, and by the third album, To Unite All Jews, their complaints went away.
Interesting.
Their complaints went away. So that was it. But it 3 parody albums and 2 original albums, 5 albums, they already were saying, oh, Schlockrock is good. Now, there's only one problem with that.
Mm-hmm. When rabbis say something is good, do kids want to listen? Answer, no. So my age of listenership started dropping. Mm-hmm. But my writing got more and more complicated, more and more complex, more and more witty, more and more intelligent. Everything that I was doing, all of a sudden I was writing these crafts, these legal song parodies that were amazing. Like Amanda Rosenstein says, I'm about to be bat mitzvah now. I'm about to be bat mitzvah now. Teach me some words of Torah. No folio of securities. Don't need a fancy reception. Don't even want a big party with lots of party favors. No limo, no limo. Hot dogs and a blanket. Don't throw away. Give it to the poor. Right? Every yeah. one of these rhymes were, it was just amazing. It was just amazing. And I was getting better and better at it, but yet it wasn't necessarily going up in age. It was going down in age. And all of a sudden my listening audience is 3 to 13 and their parents, mm-hmm. which is kind of weird.
Yeah, but, a little bit.
Yes. But what it did was it gave me lots and lots of concerts because Jewish family is a family show, right? Yeah. So the band is together in 87. We start performing in December of 87. We didn't remember the first album came out in January of 86. I started getting calls for shows in December 87. And December 87, we started doing shows. And in 88, we did 100 concerts. From 88 to 96, 100 shows a year, traveling the world. I mean, I've been to Australia 8 times, South Africa 9 times, England dozens of times. Canada, every Jewish city except for Winnipeg. Mm-hmm. America, all 50 U.S. states. I'm the only musician who's played all 50 U.S. states. And that goes probably for secular artists, too.
Yeah, you know? I'm saying the number of tour dates, it's fascinating because that's like the level of like big national touring acts are touring those numbers of dates throughout a year.
But that was another thing. We wanted to tour. We love touring. Mm-hmm. Other bands in the Jewish field, they stay home. They do shows in Brooklyn College and Queens College or in Lincoln Center or in Lincoln Square or in Avery Fisher Hall, wherever they – but they didn't want to go to play Birmingham, Alabama. They didn't want to go play Omaha, Nebraska. Mm-hmm. We loved that. I loved meeting the Jewish people, you know, and that was where I got to see the Jewish people. I got to meet – the Jewish people, whether it be in England, South Africa, Australia, Israel. I eventually moved to Israel in 1996, mm-hmm. but with my family. But the, you know, in the beginning, the first 10 years of this was in Queens. The base was in Queens, and we went on from there. So,
why do you think that concerts don't seem to really exist? Like, you guys did a lot, but generally, concerts don't really exist in the Jewish world. They did a little bit more in the past, but now it's like...
Well, wait. First thing is, concerts still exist. The problem is COVID. Concerts don't exist now because of COVID. Everything that I do is virtual.
Correct. I mean, I'm saying, I know you're putting on concerts. I'm saying, like, most Jewish acts don't go that route, as you're already touching on?
Well, you first thing is you have to. It's expensive. The it's expensive if you want to. You know, the communities, they have to pay to make it worth your while, mm-hmm. unless you're so committed that you'll do it for very little. You know,
uh-huh.
That's the first thing. The second thing is, back then, that was the way to go. You know, back then, the way you got yourself known, there were two ways. One is you had a lot of money that you put into advertising.
Uh-huh.
And the other one was that you got gigs at the JCC of Augusta, Georgia.
Uh-huh.
Jacksonville, Eitz Chaim Orthodox Shul, or, El Paso, Texas, Chabad.
Yeah.
Wherever you went, you went to these places, that was the way they found out about your music.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. Because, like, that really, in the 70s as well, you had Diaspora was touring. You had a lot of people that were touring then. And then it feels like once you got, like, the 2000s and later, it seems to be when that really, maybe it's because they were able to get their music out digitally and you didn't need as much to do that in-person route. I don't know what the reasoning was, but it seems like that shifted.
Well, once digital music started happening, and now we're in that situation where everything is digital and YouTube and, Spotify, Pandora,
mm-hmm.
it's a different industry now. Now you have to learn how to adjust,
uh-huh.
which I've kind of learned how, but not 100%, meaning there's room for improvement from my perspective. There's no reason why I shouldn't be able to play a show to 250,000 people online.
Mm-hmm.
Let's assume that after doing my 2,000 concerts over the last 30, Schlock Rock is now 34 years old. Let's assume that I have 250,000 legitimate fans, of which 50,000 are familiar with at least three albums,
uh-huh.
right? That means there should be lots and lots of Schlock Rock fans out there. And how do you find them?
Mm-hmm.
That is the adjustment.
No, I hear that.
You know, as opposed to going to Daytona Beach, Florida, and playing for the Chabad there, and you get 120 people at the show,
mm-hmm.
you now have an opportunity where you can perform, and you could get thousands upon thousands listening and watching, and you record the show. It's on YouTube. It's on Facebook, and there you go.
Mm-hmm.
Now people can go and they can watch it. They can scroll up. They can scroll down. They can give it thumbs up. They can like. They can leave a comment. They can get in touch with you. That's kind of, you know.
No, 100%. I'm going to transition a bit, but what goes into making a good parody song? What's involved in that?
So I talked about it a little bit before when I sang that song from Paul Simon from the I'll Be Called Michal. The answer is you want to mirror the lyric so that the original artist might have written it himself if he was a religious Jew.
Interesting.
Or if he was an observant Jew, or if he wanted to get a message across in Judaism. That is the key.
Mm-hmm.
The key is to mirror the lyrics. So, for instance, in the Broadway song from Greece, Summer Loving Had Me a Blast, right? You remember, you know that song, right? That's Summer Nights from Greece.
Mm-hmm.
So I did Some Lou Love Him, Don't Really Last. Some Lou Love Him, Get Dry Very Fast. Hammer's World After Yom Kippurim, Had to Buy the Arba Minim. Sukkot Days Coming Today, Gonna Sleep in My Sukkah Tonight. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Everything is mirrored. Or the Mary Poppins song, Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, which I did, soup and challah candlesticks, kiddushin is delicious, every Shabbat meal we eat is really quite nutritious, can I have some chicken served on Ima special dishes, soup and challah candlesticks, kiddushin is delicious. You could see the writer of Mary Poppins writing that verse.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same. It's the same timbre, it's the same rhyme, it's the same meter, it's everything. That's a parody.
Uh-huh.
That's what makes Weird Al Yankovic the genius that he is.
Uh-huh.
If you take a look at his lyric compared to the original person's lyric, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
And so that's what I shoot for when I write.
Mm-hmm. No, that makes sense. Is there also a thematic element? Do you try to match the theme as well? Meaning what, like, let's say you could, in theory, you have a concept you want to write about. I don't know, like you want to write about, like you're saying, like, something like about Shabbos or about something else. Is there a song that you would try to gear that into, like versus one versus another?
Pops into your head. It pops into your head. It depends on the words of the original song. So, you know, the song, Bring Back That Shabbos Feeling, right? I have a song, Bring Back That Shabbos Feeling, which is You've Lost That Loving Feeling.
Yeah.
Or You've Got That Loving Feeling. And I did it about Shabbos.
Yeah.
Right? It pops into your head, and then you have to jigsaw puzzle the words with your theme, with their meter and rhyme.
Interesting. As a writer, do you find it harder to write parodies than original music?
It's a different type of writing. Parody is jigsaw puzzle writing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where you've got your theme, you've got your lyrics, and you've got a mirror, right? You're also not writing the music.
Uh-huh.
When you write an original song, it's a totally different concept. Why? Number one is you have to ask the question, what comes first, the lyric or the music? Sometimes the music, sometimes the lyric. What do you want to write about? Where's it coming in? What's in your gut? You're connecting to a spiritual pipeline up above, that right? That spiritual pipeline is giving you ideas and vibes, right? And that's what's going on, and you're writing. And then, so that's how come when I get that vibe, I've written 12 songs in 4 days. I've written 11 songs in 6 days. My musical, Daniel in Babylon, I wrote 28 songs or 29 songs in 6 weeks. So it just came down. It came down like water. It came, just the idea, the inspiration, you know, everything just, that's how you write. That's how I write, and it's much more satisfying than writing a parody.
Mm-hmm.
Now, parody is a different type of nachas. It's a different type of pleasure that you get, because there's nothing like writing a good lyric to a parody. But for me, writing a great melody, great words, with a great rhythmic groove, you know, chords, going into the studio and turning nothing into something, that is the best.
I hear that.
And that's what I love doing.
That sounds like... It's interesting, because I was going to say, which do you like more? But I think you kind of hit on that right there, is that obviously there's great things about the parodies, but like you said, putting out that song from scratch and putting something out has a very gratifying feeling to it.
It's true. It's true. 100%.
I guess, like, we kind of touched on this also, but, like, what goes into, deciding, let's say, even, like, with modern music, right? So you've done, even stuff more recently. Like, how do you... Like you said, like, let's say the song pops into your head or the lyric pops into your head.
Right.
Are you listening to a lot of music to kind of build up like that thing of
not
what
really
to get, or where does that come from?
Right. So for the parody, not really. What happens is that a song, there's a certain, what's it called, code. How do you pick a song? So you're not going to pick a song that nobody knows, because then what's the point?
Yeah.
And so it's got to be really, really popular. So that's mm-hmm. step number one. That's the low baseline. It's got to be so popular. So like any Taylor Swift song that was really, really big and has over a billion views, you can use that. You can use any Bruno Mars song that's got over a billion views, any Meghan Trainor song, any, you know, all of this type of stuff, the song is so big.
Yeah.
Right now, you got to hope that the song has lastability,
mm-hmm.
because you don't want it to die in 3 months and then all of a sudden you have this parody and nobody even knows that song anymore, right?
Yeah.
That happened to me a couple of times in the early years. Like, I picked the song Safety Dance from Men Without Hats.
Mm-hmm.
And you could dance if you want to. You can bring the knee, right? How many people sing that song now? Nobody. But I did. You could learn if you want to. You could bring your friends along. Because if your friends learn and when your friends learn, you know they'll feel real strong, right? Anyway, not great lyrics. But that was the thing is, I picked that song, and that song really disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, you have a song like Old Time Rock and Roll from Bob Seger, which is still big,
yeah.
Or any Beatles song is still big. Beach Boys, Eagles, now the 80s is back, 70s and 80s. The kids are all listening to 80s, like, Come On, Eileen, nee, nee, nee. I haven't schlocked that I have to schlock now, maybe, because it's come back. All of a sudden, it's come back. Why has it come back? I have no idea. Is it that great a song? No. I mean, it's a good song, but...
I hear that. Have you interacted with any of these people that you've parodied over the years?
No, not really. That's a funny part. You know, you'd expect that I would have met somebody,
mm-hmm.
but I've never really met anybody. Other people have. Well, my band members have met. Every once in a while, I'll meet somebody, but
yeah,
nobody's really interested in my parodies of their original songs unless they can make a lot of money off of it. In other words, it's all about the bottom line for them, right?
Yeah, no, 100%.
Every musician really just wants to hear their own music. They love their own music. I'm not sure that people will agree with me with that, but like people always ask me, do you ever listen to your own music? The answer is yes, I do. I love listening to my own music. I love listening to certain things. Not everything, but mm-hmm. most, you know, because it's my creations from Hashem. It makes me feel good.
That makes sense. Do you think that, is there a reason why, like, I know you also put out an acapella album, but like parody seems to have shifted a lot to the acapella, both really in the Jewish and non-Jewish world. You have things like Pentatonics. You have plenty of acapella covers all over YouTube. It seems to have gone that route. It's almost like, in some ways it's great, in some ways it almost feels lacking. Like you want that electric guitar, you want that, like, the real drum and something like that. It has like an extra feel to it.
I agree with you. It's an interesting phenomenon. Why did it happen that acapella went to schlockapella, which is what I put out this album called Schlockapella?
Uh-huh.
But I did it only after acapella was humongously big. I think it's because of the college camaraderie. You know, in other words, part uh-huh. of the reason that acapella became what it was is because of the colleges. Because the kids would go off to college and they would form groups and sing, right? And you'd have your music. You'd have your music director. And he would be, you know, saying, okay, we're going to do this, we're going to do this. And then the kids, you know, I don't know, somehow they wrote parodies. Maybe I had something to do with it. Maybe a lot of these kids grew up on schlock rock. I certainly know that the Maccabees, who I'm very friendly with, grew up on me. And, I mean, the truth is I get that from a lot of artists. They'll come up to me and they say, I grew up on your music. I loved your music. So the thing that you need to understand is I'm building on Weird Al Yankovic. I'm building on Rechnitzer Rejects, Country Yossi and the Stiebelhoppers, Tom Lehrer, Alan Sherman, right? All those people, Mickey Katz. It's like a pyramid. It goes all the way up. So, like, I did make a dent, certainly, in rock and roll, Jewish rock and roll. And then they took it to the next level.
Yeah.
The Maccabees have certainly taken it to the next level in terms of fame, in terms of popularity, and also parodies. They do parodies, and 613, and what's that other group called? So many of them. There's so many Jewish parody groups. I don't want to leave anybody out. So, you know, AKA Pella and 613, and, you know, those guys.
Yeah, it's also interesting, like you were talking about, I think Weird Al said, I think after his last album, he made a comment of how, like, he almost feels, not lacking, but he had just gotten out of a record deal when he released that last album. He's like, finally, I could, like, release songs, like, parodies right away. Because, like, when you were just putting out records, you can put out, you can make a whole parody album, and nobody else is putting songs out the second a song is, like, hot on the radio. And it's like an interesting dynamic of, like, where to do a single versus putting out an album. And, like, do you feel any kind of pressure to, I wouldn't say pressure, but putting out stuff soon after a song comes out to try to capitalize on the popularity of the song versus waiting till you compile a full album?
I personally like doing a whole album at once, but that's not the business anymore.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the business. The business is Weird Al is right. You want to capitalize. You want to put out the song immediately. I just don't. I mean, right now my head isn't really in parodies, although I've got this idea to do a classic schlock rock parody album now. It just started coming, so maybe it'll happen. But first I want to do an original album, which I haven't done in a while. Truth is that with this COVID and with the way, you know, you have to be very, in order to write, you have to have simcha, right? Mm-hmm. You have to have, you know, a lot of happiness and that's how you get vibe, and that's how you write. And having simcha right now is hard for people, and it's hard for everybody because, you know, you're really, you know, you're taking a look. You see my room. This is my office. I spend most of the time here. I don't really go out. Although I had COVID back in October, just to let everybody know, and I got through it, and it was fine, thank God. But, you know, I'm not even eligible to be vaccinated now. So even if I wanted to be vaccinated, I can't be vaccinated because I have high antibodies. You know, nobody really knows. So you're sitting here. It's very hard. You know, you get down. You get a little depressed, the world, and blah, blah, blah. You have to have simcha. So in order for me to record, I need simcha and I need money, both. Money and simcha. Yeah. And then, of course, you need the inspiration. You have to write new material. So that's where I'm up to right now, you know.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. You were talking again about original music. Do you prefer writing in Hebrew or English, or do you have a preference between the two?
Of course I prefer in English, because English is my first language. Hebrew is my second, even though, you know, I'm here in Israel, and I speak Hebrew, you know, fluently, but dikduk is a little bit of a problem, or dikduk. My grammar is not so great, but first thing is, if I were to write a Hebrew song with my own words in Hebrew, I would need a coach to correct me.
Uh-huh, yeah.
That's number one. But in English, I don't need a coach to correct me. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, it's very easy to fall back on writing psukim, on using phrases from the Tehillim, from Psalms, from the Torah, from Haftorah, from the Nevi'im, to write songs. And, you know, I've done that a lot. I've done that a lot. A lot of albums with that.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. We were talking again, I'm going to jump back a little bit to what we were saying earlier. We were talking about how, like, using parodies for education and teaching Jewish themes and Jewish concepts. Do you see parody music and music in general to be as much of an effective tool in Kirov as it was, let's say, in the 80s and 90s today? Do you think it plays that same role?
I 100% do. If used correctly, yes. Because remember, what is the point? It gives you simcha. Makes you smile.
Mm-hmm.
Makes you smile, makes you laugh. And then maybe if the hook is good, you'll sing along, right?
Yeah.
And if the guy is really good, you'll sing along and you'll want to sing his songs. And then it makes you happy. And that's what it's all about, Judaism. Beli simcha, right? If you have Judaism without happiness, it's not great. It's a sadness. It's a sad...
I hear that.
That's what, you know, Schlock Rock meant happiness. It meant spreading happiness and education, but also smile and comedy. You're laughing. You're also learning. You're learning. You're laughing. You're smiling. All of that. Jewish pride, Jewish identity, Jewish awareness, Jewish continuity, Jewish education. It's timeless. Schlock Rock is timeless. Parodies are timeless also. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do think that there's always going to be a place. And think about it. It's not just me. Back in the 20s, people would do these Yiddish songs, and they would all be 20s and 30s,
uh-huh.
And they'd have comedy, words of comedy in Yiddish, and people would love that. So definitely, the answer is there's always going to be a place for this type of stuff.
That makes a lot of sense. It's interesting. We talked earlier about, let's say, receiving pushback even for just doing parodies and rock music, and now you also, I think, were one of the first people to introduce rap into the Jewish music scene, which now is a pretty big element of the Jewish music scene.
Right.
But what was that like initially? Like you said, like you had reached a level with the rabbis and then being comfortable with the music you're putting out. And then you almost like went and stepped it to another level. Like what was that? Did you have like a whole nother level of pushback, or like what was that element like in that process?
No, not really. Rap. You know, let me tell you how it is.
Mm-hmm.
This is how it is. If you have to, you know, if you are owned by another organization,
mm-hmm.
then you got to follow their rules, right?
Yeah.
The great thing about Schlock Rock was we were so controversial in the beginning. We were never owned by anybody.
Interesting.
So I could push the envelope any place I wanted to within reason. Obviously, I'm not going to put nudity. I'm not going to do crude behavior, crude language. But we did whatever we wanted to do. Somebody said, no, you can't do rap. I said, oh, yes, we can. We can do rap. Of course we can do rap. What are you talking about? What are the kids listening to? They're listening to rap. Rap is big. We have to do rap, right? Reggae is big. We have to do reggae. Grunge is big. We have to do grunge. And, you know, we did. We did whatever, you know. But the great news was we weren't owned by anybody.
Mm-hmm.
So nobody could say, not allowed. We forbid you from releasing this song. Nobody ever said that to me because it was my baby, you know, with Hashem, you know.
100%. I think in that way also, do you think there's room for Jewish music even to cross into the mainstream in a sense with maybe not overtly Jewish-themed lyrics or maybe even with that, but kind of crossing into musically into the mainstream?
So we saw Matisyahu do that, right?
Correct, yeah.
But not with parody, with original. And what's he singing about? Spirituality. Spirituality, God, purpose of life.
Yeah.
And they went for it. And it, he was a big hit. One Day and all the other songs that he has that that talked about God and talked about kingdom of Hashem and youth and glory and, you know, he was fantastic. He was a fantastic, you know, it was a fantastic vehicle to make people aware of God, because Judaism, not Judaism, but let's say spirituality, awareness of God is not just a Jewish thing. It's for everybody, you know.
It's a universal concept.
Yes, it's universal. So what about parodies? So the Maccabees did that with their song Candlelight. They crossed over.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't. My music has not really crossed.
Uh-huh.
Not really crossed. My music has been for the Jewish community. Is it possible for one or two songs to cross over? Yes, I have.
Mm-hmm.
But it hasn't happened. So, you know, you have to say to yourself, obviously, there's a purpose for you. There's a purpose for the Maccabees. There's a purpose for Matisyahu. Everybody's got their own place. There's a purpose for the Moshav Band. There's a purpose for Eighth Day, and so on and so forth. So, and you have to know what that is.
Yeah. Do you have in your own music songs that you feel like have connected more with people than others? Like, are there songs that like you know as the writer, either before they came out or definitely after they came out, that this song really hits with people in a certain way?
Sure. That's called hit songs. That's how you know how to play. You have to play the hits, right?
True.
I absolutely know what to play, and I know what people are going to ask me. When I go to a show, I could write down the song list, and then I say to people, okay, what do you want to hear? And they will pick every song that's on the list.
Uh-huh.
You know, occasionally they'll pick a song that I've never played, you know, or that I never play. And then they're really, really fans that know all the material. But in general, they'll ask for the hits. They'll ask for Achashverosh. They'll ask for Yo-Yo Yarmulke. They'll ask for Minion Man. They'll ask for, you know, Am Yisrael Chai. They'll ask for Ani Yehudi.
Yeah.
They'll ask for Hinei Matov. They'll ask for We've Got a Strong Desire, and so on and so on and so on. There were certain songs that they're just going to ask for. Would I like that they ask for the newer material? Yes. Will they ask for the newer material? No, they will not. Unless they are phenomenally versed in all 39 of my albums.
Because
there are 39 albums, and you got to be really into my 39 albums to know the stuff that comes later, because the later stuff, it's not the same as when I first came out. When I first came out, I was 26 years old, 26, 27, 28, right? And now I just turned the big 6-0. I'm 60. So, you know, that's the...
Father Time and all that.
I feel 22. I feel 22, yeah, but
good old Taylor
you know
Swift.
When you're you know there's a certain, I guess let's call it shelf life, and I can keep putting out stuff. My really good fans will listen to everything I put out, but is it going to, will it be a number one hit that everybody wants to sing? The odds are it might, but it will take some, you know. It's Hashem. It's up to Hashem.
Yeah, 100%. Do you have any personal favorites from the later stuff that like you feel like?
Of course.
You wish people had like gravitated that towards that more.
Me personally, do I have more personal favorites from the later songs?
Your personal favorite, yeah.
Are they requested? No.
Can you maybe share with me some of those of your own personal favorites?
Sure, Rav Yehuda Hanasi from Aladdin, from Still Not Quite on Broadway. What else? From the new Shul album, Hey Brother from Avicii.
Mm-hmm.
Transnistria from the song Africa from Toto. Ed Sheeran, Shape of You is now called Torah Jew.
Uh-huh.
Bruno Mars, Runaway Baby is called Runaway Jacob. It's such a great, it's a great song. And it's such a fun tune to play. We've actually played it in concert a number of times.
Nice. I feel like it's also like you were saying earlier of how your writing style has developed and you're wordplay is developed, which I feel like makes even more sense why, as the writer, like, you even, like, gravitate even more to those songs, because, like, you see in your own personal growth through your music. I think that's kind of...
Yes, you grow and you get better at this. You get better. Yeah. And people always say, oh, you know, and they send me a lyric, and they say, do you like this? And I go, you can't just rhyme Torah with Mora with Hora with Masora. It's got to be more complex than that.
Yeah.
And sometimes the people get offended. And I write back, I said, I'm not trying to offend you. I'm trying to teach you, because I can't put that out. I could do that my first album. My first album, I could rhyme Torah with Hora with Mora, right?
Yeah.
But my 40th album or 41st album, you can't do that anymore, you know?
100%. Like, you could see it in the secular world, like, with people like Eminem. Like, their skill, a lot of these rappers especially, like, their skill is fine. Like, you're, like, on the next level when you can find these ways to rap and to rhyme words.
Yeah.
That people don't have couldn't even think to rhyme them, and you find a way to make it work.
Yes. They evolve. They've evolved into advanced beatology, if you want to call it. Their beats with their words, advanced, very advanced. And how they do it, when I first heard, like, 3 words in a half a second, oh my gosh, that's unbelievable. Yeah. You know, and then you try to imitate that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that you definitely grow and you get better and better and better. So if people would say to me, what's your favorite stuff? I would say the later stuff is always more favorite for me, because I think it's better. I think it's the best. But it's not necessarily the most popular, you know.
No, that makes sense. Where do you see the place? I know we've talked about where your music fits in the Jewish world, but music more broadly in the Jewish world. What do you think, like, what's the role of music?
Of music or my music?
Of music in general.
So music, without music, we would be very, in a very bad place. Music is crucial. And you see it, because you see the need for the streaming services and everything. And in Jewish music also. Jewish music, you need music. Music gives you, it goes straight to your soul. It goes straight to your soul. Whether it be classical with no lyrics, whether it be rap with no music, you know, no background music, whether it be, you know, jazz, whether it be a cappella, whether it be rock and roll, heavy metal, and they all shape your mood.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not a Metallica fan in general, but Metallica to me is dark. There's darkness in Metallica.
Mm-hmm.
Now, am I wrong? I could be wrong, because I haven't really given it the time. Other people love Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan is the greatest philosopher musician who ever lived.
Yeah.
But I've never been able to get into him. Mm-hmm. I can't get past his voice. But other people say to me, Lenny, you're missing out. You have to see what he is saying. So, you see, music, there's a place for everything musical. And whether you like lyrics better, whether you like music better, whether you like harmonies, whether you like rhythm, whatever you like, and it shapes you. It shapes your mood. You know, if you're in a bad mood, I always say, find the music that you like, put it on, it's going to change your mood. That's what it will do.
Yeah, no, 100%.
It's a mood changer. It's an emotional changer.
Yeah, you touched briefly when you mentioned Metallica on harder rock or metal or whatever like that. Do you think there's a reason why, like, you guys, like, played rock, but, like, even, like, the heavier stuff has never really transitioned into Judaism, even if you had the right lyrics? Do you think there's a reason why that is?
Yeah, it's hard to digest, maybe. It's hard to digest. I know that jazz hasn't really gone into Jewish music either. I mean, some people are going to say to me or you, or after they hear this podcast, you're wrong, Lenny. There's this group, there's that group. Yes, but it's not for the masses. But then again,
more broadly, it doesn't cross over.
You know, on the other hand, the Yiddish Fiddler on the Roof, people went crazy.
Yeah.
Every night, sold out, right? Why? Well, first thing is, Fiddler on the Roof is a musical. Second thing is, the songs are melodic. Third thing is, Yiddish. They somehow connected with the Yiddish, right?
Yeah.
So that, you know, so heavy metal, just, I don't know, heavy, there are, sometimes people say to me, do a metal album, but I, I'd have to get the songs and I'd have to go over it and I'd have to be able to digest it. You know, mm-hmm. So what's the hardest stuff that I ever did? The hardest metal, you know, Jump from Van Halen was pretty, you know, I did also, you give love a bad name.
Bon Jovi.
Bon Jovi, yeah. But that's pop. It's not really metal.
Yeah, it's pop rock more so in that way.
Yeah, I haven't really done metal. Yeah.
I feel like what's interesting to me about rock music in general is that rock music, the lyrics are some like, even like, are very deep and hard-hitting, I think a lot of the time, depending on obviously which band, but like I think it also, what I find a beauty in rock is the fact that like, these are the people who write it are the bands that have been together for a while versus somebody who isn't necessarily experiencing the music. Like the people who are writing the music, they experience it, they live together, and they're putting out music together, I think is what's interesting to me about that genre in general.
Well, that's the way all the groups did it. All the groups did that in the old days. You know, the Eagles used to get together in a hotel or in a big mansion and they would write songs.
Yeah.
And they never got along. Ooh, they didn't get along at all, the Eagles. But they wrote the most beautiful stuff. Harmonies and guitar licks and everything, but they hated each other.
Yeah.
That's kind of weird. You know, even the Beatles, who probably, of course, would be considered the greatest musical group just in terms of from the 60s to the 70s.
Yeah.
They didn't get along either for, you know, they had their ups and downs. You know, because you live with somebody, it's
not hard. The easiest thing in the world.
No.
Yeah, no, we just touched on a bunch of them now, but are there any other any of your like musical influences either in like the Jewish world or the secular world that really drove your music?
Yeah, so growing up, I had Ruach, I had Shlomo Carlbach a little bit, but not a lot. I mean, I was singing his songs, I didn't know it was him.
Uh-huh.
Certainly his stories did not reach me until I was much older, but the Diaspora Yeshiva Band, Magama Duo, Judea, I love the group Judea, which I don't know how many people have heard of. They only put out one album, but it was a great album. What else? Ruach. Ruach was a group when I was 13. I got their red record for a bar mitzvah present.
Mm-hmm.
I loved their stuff, and they also harmonized so beautifully. That's in the Jewish world. Then in the secular world, Billy Joel, the Beatles, all music of the 70s and 80s, Boston, Chicago, ELO. I loved Squeeze. Squeeze was a group in the 80s, an English group. I loved them, and I still do. So there was the secular group that I loved. And then, you had the parody groups, which Weird Al and Tom Lehrer and Alan Sherman. So you had those people. So, you know, you combine those three, and you get Lenny, who started out from eight years old, learning accordion for 10 years, and then piano for 3, and I came from a very musical family, my chazanim on both sides of my mother and father's family,
uh-huh.
And I learned how to, you know, I'm a bar mitzvah teacher here in Beit Shemesh. I've taught over 60 boys their parsha, and I play, you know, I play gigs, but that's how I became who I became. And also I became who I became because of happiness, because I grew up very happy, very, you know, with a great neighborhood, with great friends, with great parents, brother, sister. The schools were good also, you know, Yeshiva Central Queens in Jamaica, and then MTA, and then Queens College, which I loved for the music stuff. So that was how I came out. I came out. A lot of it is your surroundings, you know, and how you become who you become, and then you have to learn how to react in the world. You have to learn how to deal with the world. All of a sudden, music is a business, you know.
Yeah,
that's interesting. Also,
do you have any like favorite stories from touring or anything like that you would want to share?
Okay, so we've played Anchorage, Alaska. That was a great show. We were brought out to Anchorage by this really nice family, and we were flying to Anchorage, and then they make an announcement that the volcano has erupted in Mount St. Helens, and they're diverting us to L.A. So we're in L.A. waiting to get on a plane to Anchorage, and while we're waiting to see the lady at the counter, there's an earthquake. So we have an earthquake and we have a volcano eruption in like a span of 5 hours. And then we finally get to Alaska and we're driving and we see a sign, road closed because of avalanche. So, you know, you're talking like this is Queen's boy has had an earthquake, a volcano eruption, and an avalanche in like 24 hours. So that was interesting. On that same trip, we were at the Chabad Davening Musaf. We started with 10 people, which is a minyan. And when we finished Shmona Esrei, somebody had left. So there were only nine. So we started with 10, but there were only nine. So we didn't have a minyan. But, you know, you still count as if there was. So yeah. That was my Anchorage, Alaska story. We've had other great, great stories. You know, like Baltimore, we played the Maccabi games for 24,000 people. We were the opening ceremonies. In Israel, when I released the Liverpool album, the Shabbat in Liverpool album, which was all Beatles songs set to Shabbat, Tfilah and Zmirot, yeah. They loved it so much, I became a celebrity on a game show in Israel. So I was in an Israeli game show as a celebrity. That was unbelievable. You know, I've had the opportunity to do a lot of things that nobody has had a chance to do. So Yo 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 Yarmulke, one of our rap songs, is in the Trivial Pursuit game. Uh-huh. There's a question on Schlock Rock in a Trivial Pursuit game. So like things have happened to us that are frankly amazing. You know, where we experienced and to this day we always meet people and they say, oh, I grew up on your music. We love your music. We still love your music. Our kids are listening now. Keep up the good work. Yeah. That's kind of the validation of the career. You know, mm-hmm. The validation of the career 34 years later, people are still saying fantastic music. We love it.
100%. You know? I know now you're working on your nonprofit project, the Four Corners Project. I don't know if you want to tell me a little bit more about that and what that.
Yes, very
entails.
Simple. So the music business has changed. Schlock Rock used to be a for-profit corporation. It's still a for-profit corporation, but because there are no gigs, because there are, you need money to put out albums, and people don't buy albums. They basically take the music for free. So we created a not-for-profit organization, a 501c3 tax-deductible organization called the Four Corners Project. And there's a website, www.4cornersproject.org. And there we take donations, and that enables us to keep going, to make projects. I have on the agenda this year, I have a webisode called Exploring Israel, Lenny Solomon Live, which is my three times a week rock show, the Jewish music show, which I go on and I perform and I talk. And then I have, I want to do two new albums, one parody, one original, and then mm-hmm. a bunch of music videos too. So these are all things that I can only do if I'm funded. And that's what the Four Corners Project is. It's just really Schlock Rock, but it became a not-for-profit organization so that people could get a tax donation and we can keep producing content which helps people love Judaism. Because there's a bigger picture. The bigger picture is not just Lenny making music, but it's Lenny making music that inspires and people love.
You touched on it earlier, but you're also working on a musical as well, if you'd like to tell me a little about that.
Right. Well, I wrote a musical called Daniel in Babylon. You could see it in my background over my shoulder. It's a musical. It's it's 29 songs, 100 minutes long, and it's on the Book of Daniel. So I don't know if people don't. It's really good. So as soon as we get investor money for that, that will be a full feature film. It'll be a movie.
Uh-huh.
So these are all things. These are big things. You know, these are things that we have to wait for Hashem to give it the go ahead. Right now in the COVID world, kind of things are in limbo. They're on hold uh-huh. right now. And you kind of have to have patience.
Yeah, no, 100%. Just thank you again for joining us. Where can people find you on the internet, on social media, wherever, if people want to find you?
Okay, very easy. Facebook Lenny Solomon and Facebook Lenny Solomon in Hebrew. Then Facebook, there's a Schlock Rock page and there's a Four Corners Project page. So that's Facebook. YouTube, there's a Schlock Rock channel and there's a Four Corners Project channel. Email just lenny@schlockrock.com. You know, Twitter @LennySolomon, @SchlockRock, @FourCornersProject, and @DanielInBabylon. I have four Twitter handles if you want to get a hold of me there. I'm very accessible to write to me. If you want to find out more about anything, that's how you do it. And it was great being on your podcast.
Pleasure. I'm so happy you were able to join, and it was a lot of fun. So thank you.
My pleasure. And everybody out there, keep on schlocking.
Hey guys, I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did. For more conversations like the one you just heard, please follow us on Instagram at OurFaithThrough, THRU, music, and subscribe in your favorite podcasting app. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great rest of your day.